All right, welcome back to the Front Side, the podcast. I'm Charles.
And I'm Brandon.
And we actually have a name this week. Episode 2.
Episode 2.
Just as promised.
We have a name, which we've creatively done by rearranging the words in the Front Side podcast to be Front Side, the podcast. So see if you can spot that. hope you guys are quick on the uptake, because we like to keep people on their toes.
Do we have theme music yet?
No. Apparently, we can't license actual Tupac music, so we'll work on it. We'll see if EMI or whoever will work with us on it.
Mm-hmm. We're building a name. We got to build a name first.
Yeah,
and then
maybe Jimmy Iovine or some exec is like, hey, big fan of the show. I love listening to people, you know, yammer on and on about programming subjects, and you guys have a really great sound, and I would like you to have this Tupac song. I think Picture Me Rollin' would probably be my choice, but you know.
You know, I never knew. You actually educated me that posthumous Tupac was called Machiavelli.
Yes. And
I never knew that.
I don't know where that actually came from, like where all of my like late 90s post, you know, it was sort of like post coastal beef where, you know, the war had kind of settled. You know, the government had clearly conspired to actually, like, neither of them are dead, right? Like, neither Tupac or Biggie. They're both on some private island, and the government has them safely tucked away, which is the only explanation for, like, the 45 posthumous albums released under the name Machiavelli for Tupac Shakur. Yeah. So how I know all that stuff, I honestly don't remember, you know, late 90s. I don't think anybody remembers that. Yeah. Crazy Town was there. There was some Chumbawamba.
Cats and dogs
living together. Yeah. So that was, I don't know. I just would love to have that as the thing is, if we got Tupac, you would have to just lay it under the entire podcast.
Just like this like obnoxious resonating beat. Mm-hmm. Actually, not obnoxious is not the word. There.
It's not the right word.
Sorry.
Not for those production values. No.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I have to, speaking of making self-correction, I have to correct something I said on the previous podcast. And I say a lot of incorrect things, but I don't want to get actually crucified by, you know, the internet or whatever. And I said something. I was talking about Brandon the Ship Burner. It's actually Brandon the Shipbuilder. Okay. A big difference.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know.
One
of those minus one plus one type things.
I think clearly there would be, you know, a nice syncope to their to their work. But they probably would not coexist peacefully necessarily. Mm-hmm. So, but as you said, there are many Brandons in the story. Yeah, you don't want Game of Thrones nerds coming after you.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
no.
Like if you had missaid Dagron the Magnificent or whatever. Ooh, man. We are going to get letters. People do not like when they find me making fun of what is it? Historical fiction? I'm not familiar with the Game of Thrones. I'm assuming it's set in medieval times.
It is.
It's actually set in medieval times.
Right.
Where the manager of the medieval times has a throne. Made of like toy swords or something.
There were no dragons in medieval times. Therefore, there are no dragons at medieval times.
So I feel like I'm close on this one though.
Yeah.
Like, so don't correct me. Let's just keep going.
Let's go. But okay.
Yeah. So we're episode 2.
We got a few things laid out for the menu. That we can kind of pick and choose from.
I think we should just jump right into it. We could just riff for the next, you know, 45 minutes, hour and a half, two mm-hmm. hours. Like mm-hmm. really, just honestly, if somebody's listening to this podcast, just know it might say a half hour on the dial. We actually have tricked your player. This is a 2.5 hour podcast. So just sit down and buckle up.
We pack 3 hours into 30 minutes.
Hope you're listening at 2x speed.
Mm-hmm.
So
we are dedicated to keep it bite sized.
Yeah.
So we'll get right into it.
Big fan of not having people completely burn my day on this stuff. So yeah, we have a topic for today, and I think this is a pretty good one. I actually think we basically discussed it, and I think it's probably a good idea. Even though this is only our second episode, it's probably a good idea to start taking the devil's advocate position to the stuff that we normally tell people to do. We're front side, Frontside is a shop where we do a lot of client-side MVC work, primarily in Ember. We're big fans of the technology and big fans of the kind of cool stuff it enables you to do. But I thought it would be really cool to take kind of a devil's advocate point of view and talk about the times where it doesn't make sense or times where people are going to run into challenges that they may not be expecting when trying to use client-side MVC. Because I think the whitewashing of that is something that happens a lot where, no, just use this cool new technology and everything will turn out great.
It'll be just fine.
Yeah. So, like, it's time for some real talk. Like, the stuff that people won't tell you about, the stuff or the stuff that's really challenging, or even if it's stuff that you're committed to doing and you run into it, you know you're not crazy. It's not you that's stupid. So that's something that I think would be potentially valuable to people that are developing web applications.
Right. Especially, yeah, and not to say, like, we fall pretty much on the other side of the fence, but this is something that it does need to be acknowledged. So I don't know, where should we start?
Let's start at the start, man. Like, okay, so let's contrast really fast. So for people that are building web applications, usually, let's say in our universe, it's primarily a Rails world, and you start building a web application, and it's something you can kind of show somebody to do in a day. I help coach Rails Girls classes and stuff periodically, and within a day, people have had the experience of having built a web application, and that's very cool. And so the experience of getting that stuff, like, certainly the install can be kind of a pain. Ruby itself is, like, no actual picnic for a lot of people to get going and get dialed in, but once that's all done, it's pretty much Rails new. And Rails generate. Right. And if you want tests, the tests are included. All of that stuff. So I think something that something that feels a little different, and I'm curious to get your take on this, on some of the challenges with it and how you've seen people stumble on it and what you do now to get over it, to get past that initial hurdle of, okay, I would like to try something like Ember. Help me get that set up in my project. What do I do?
Right. Well, okay. So I don't really have that much experience with the getting it integrated with the project, like set, like the initial generation of where to put your router, where to put your controllers, all that stuff. Like, I mean, I know where they would go, but kind of getting the initial setup, aside from, like, you know, using the Rails gem, for it, where I see the biggest hurdle that people have to leap is this idea, because when you're setting up a default web application, you almost get it's almost like you get to start from the Big Bang with every request, because every request is completely stateless. You're just, you know, whenever you get a new request coming in from the setup to where you actually get to the Rails controller action to when you're finishing the action and tearing down and, like, you know, either committing or rolling back the transaction, it's almost like it's its own, each request is its own universe. And moving from that to, you know, I've got this thing that's just on all the time and everything is connected to everything else and everything affects everything else. And if I get dirty, it's going to affect everything else. Or if I get in some inconsistent state, it's going to affect everything else. And, like, kind of, it's hard to put your finger on it, but adjusting your mindset to that always on, always persistent, always stateful, I think is a big leap for people. And it's confusing. And so there's a big cognitive gap that needs to be jumped.
It's almost as if the more you know about server-side MVC, the less likely you are to be able to grok this stuff immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took me a really long time to wrap my mind around the idea that when you travel from link to link and from route to route inside an Ember application, that the controllers are persistent across. Mm-hmm. This is true. Backbone, I assume it's true with Angular. And that was a really hard thing for me to get my head around. And that's why you have to unlearn all of this stuff so that you can kind of learn a more traditional desktop style MVC buildup of where all this state kind of sits there and floats around and you just are exchanging sub pieces of it out of a shared data pool.
Right. And so, I mean, just from there's that leap you know, from the perspective of the developer, and then from the perspective of the business owner, the pool that they can draw on of developers who can help them get the features that they need today, because that is a real concern. I mean, it might not be, you know, you might look at, you know, the ideal solution to a problem and the solution you can have right now, and it might just be that because it takes time for people to kind of get adjusted, it's kind of like changing, you know, from walking around on land to swimming in the sea. If you've got the right equipment, if you're acclimated, you can get around just as quickly, but the number of kind of sea explorers is different than the number of people who are walking around on land. So if you have something that's written using kind of a classic server MVC, you're going to be able to tap into a larger pool of developers who are already familiar with that and can change it and can modify it and can enhance it. And so while the set of interactions might be more limited that you can do, you're going to actually be able to have the system that you need today. In other words, what makes software good is how well it can react to change. And how well it can react to change is dependent in part on having the people who can enact the change. Do you see what I'm, does that make sense?
Yeah, I kind of, like, I was getting ready to jump into step one of like, okay, what are the technical problems people encounter? Yeah. But I actually think you're exactly right to hit, like, no, there's a step zero here. And step zero is taking a look at the concepts and grasping the concepts that you're about to dive into, because they're going to be very foreign and this water is going to be ice cold and it's going to shock your system and you're going to get out and walk. Right. Like, and it might be it's sort of actually like the hero's journey a little bit, if you're familiar with that from Joseph Campbell, where there's an initial call and then there's a refusal of the call. And then eventually it comes back to you once they've sort of grasped, oh wait, I'm supposed to do this. I think for me, it was a lot like that, where I initially made an attempt to learn this stuff. I made an attempt to learn Backbone and then Ember, and I couldn't really hack it. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't wrap my brain around these concepts. And so at some point I got frustrated and basically was ready to flip a table and said, you know, if I had only done this in the technology that I know, this would have been easy. Instead, I've made it much too hard for myself and I gave up. And it was about 6 months before I came back around and gave it another shot with a fresh pair of eyes, and it was a totally different experience. Mm-hmm. But it took talking to people like you, and took pairing with people to really grok and understand the full. Like, there are basically several pillars that a person needs to understand in order to use a framework like that. Chief among them is that concept of statefulness and stateful interaction. And the fact that clicking links and hitting routes in your browser doesn't necessarily mean a full from scratch rebuilding of the entire universe. It's, you know, it's the you know, if you want to bake an apple pie, first you have to invent the universe. That's the culture of the web. Like, that's how web browsers work, is you have to invent the universe. First there's a big bang, and then it goes and it asks for the right data, and it goes and does all this stuff and then presents it on the screen. And that's really cool. That's a very cool interaction, and it's scaled really well over the last 30 years. But there's a class of interactions that doesn't really support well. But being able to grasp that, I think, is probably the number one challenge that I ran into. So it's cool that you brought that up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, and there are definitely a lot of pragmatic concerns too. I mean, if you have to support older versions of IE6, IE7, God forbid, you know, most people, a lot of people still support IE8. And 9, like, the further back you want to reach, the more from the times of those technologies that you're going to have to use. And that's a practical concern. The other thing is, if you don't require large amount of interaction, you know, it might just make sense that you can build stuff out just faster. If you can build stuff out faster and just classic forms over data.
Well,
you know,
and we
said
this,
go for it.
Yeah, we had this experience recently where we were trying to help somebody basically convert a style that was written in this form over data and help them get going on it and get working in it. And they took it a ways down the road and then eventually realized that when their nose was against a deadline, like, they knew exactly how to do this in Rails. They knew exactly how to do this in traditional server-side architecture. And so the additional effort of trying to make an interaction design that's really optimized for something like Rails, trying to make that work in an MVC client-side architecture like Ember, that wound up being painful enough that they weren't ready to pay that tax. And there wasn't the benefit for having paid the tax. So you pay the tax.
The most important thing for them was to get to market quickly.
Right.
And go with, you know, and so making something that was, you know, known to them and reliable and, you know, and in fairness too, extensible in ways that, you know, the more avant-garde technologies might not be extensible was. For example, you know, A/B testing is a big requirement. There's a plethora of A/B
would
testing.
You say, I have a plethora of A/B gems.
Exactly. So, you know, those, if you want to A/B test, I don't know, the temperature of your bathwater, there's a plugin for Rails for it.
Yeah.
I mean, the ecosystem that is available, there is, you know, for any given particular problem, you know, the likelihood of there being a mature ecosystem for it or a plugin or extension that serves that need.
That
is very, very high when you're using, you know, a simple stock Rails system as opposed to, you know, a more modern client-side MVC framework.
I think that's a really good point. And I think what I would take out of that is that really knowing what your goal is and knowing what your priorities are. And I think we don't do this enough where you sit down and evaluate your priorities. Is this something where a user experience is paramount? It is the quality of the experience for the end user is the number one thing we need to solve. Or is the ability to A/B test something paramount? Or is the ability to know that this is going to work in all browsers your number one concern?
Right.
And we've run into this a few times. I certainly have, where I build something to this sort of specification where internally, like, I'm very user experience oriented. And so I feel like I've delivered something that has delivered a great user experience. And another developer that's very code quality oriented would be like, this is the best tested widget you're ever going to find of this. And they go, I don't care how well it's tested. It was supposed to ship 2 weeks ago. Now I don't make any money and we're out of business. Thanks a lot. And so understanding where those trade-offs are supposed to have been made is really important. And client-side stuff does involve some trade-offs. There's trade-offs in the setup cost of getting the stuff up and running. That's been smoothed out quite a bit, but it involves JavaScript. And spoiler alert, JavaScript, the universe of JavaScript build tools is very fast-moving. It's relatively complex, and it can be challenging to find resources that can educate you on how to use all of this stuff. Fortunately, in Rails, there are several options to make things really simple. But if for a friend of mine who I've been helping build a Sinatra app and looking for the state of build tools for people that are using like plain JavaScript, for instance, we got this application up and running, and we currently, until we don't want to shave that big hairy yak that's sitting right there of setting up JavaScript build tools. So we keep inserting handlebars templates into the DOM of index.html with script tags. And if you've used Ember, that will sound familiar because that's how tutorials tell you, you know, kind of do use this to get your legs underneath you, but you really should move to using individual handlebars files. But that means there's now you are guaranteed to require a build step. That's great if you're using Rails because Asset Pipeline makes that very basically free. Asset Pipeline and Gems, that's a pretty much a free interaction. But if you're doing something like Sinatra or you're doing something like shipping this app by itself, you suddenly have to enter really what right now is a big old bag of hurt. And that is, we're going to get letters. But the JavaScript, I don't think anybody would dispute that the state of JavaScript build tools is at least somewhat chaotic at the moment. And so that step zero of just getting this thing set up and running, fortunately for people in Rails, it's relatively straightforward. But for everyone else on the planet, this thing is kind of tough. And there are tools coming up like Ember App Kit that are trying to make this easier. But it's because it's actually a surprisingly challenging problem.
Yep. Yeah. It comes to like even distributing components. Like if you want to make a library, there's no really set way, no clear path forward I know of. I would love for somebody to send me a letter on this one, send me an angry letter telling me I'm wrong. But if I've come up with the greatest widget of all time or the greatest class of all time or some module that I want to make available to the internet, there is no way to, there's no one way to bring it into your application and just have it be there and just have it be served and just have it be concatenated at the right time and just be combined with the right dependencies
distribution. And if distribution is a problem, that means that access is a problem. It means that there aren't all the people that have these cool ideas and want to share them. Node makes that very easy with NPM modules. And so you see a billion of those. But when you start actually getting into the client side of things, things that need to be loaded into the browser.
And we see this with Bower being able to at least package up the assets and distribute them, but like to actually include them into your application in an orderly manner. It's still...
It's a little bit like the Wild West.
Yeah,
and that
it
can
is.
Be, that can feel... For somebody that's used to the, for people from Rails that remember when Rails and Ruby Gems was like the Wild West, that may be somewhat comfortable. Like, there's a lot of source diving, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for people that are used to basically having, you know, a really good tutorial and a really good screencast and a really good XYZ, for pretty much 90% of the problems that you'll encounter, somebody else has encountered it, somebody else has documented it, and you don't have to dive through the source code of everything that you use in order to make use of it. So those are really good points. Before we kind of close this out, and I want to keep the discussion kind of short, and we can talk about it again another day. And there's more to dive into.
We should probably summarize.
Yeah, and I would like to, so let's kind of tie it together, like, and then ask, when do you know? This is what I would ask you. When do you know? Maybe it's time to pack it in on trying this like cool avant-garde new technology that you're using and go back to the tools that you know, and when to stick through it and actually plow through and try to complete with the tool, with the new cool shiny.
Right. That's a really good question.
That's why I asked you, because I don't have a good answer.
For me, I mean, it almost, okay. So for me, the real questions are, we didn't really get a chance to talk about SEO, but that's something that is doable, but it's still a pain in the ass. You have to kind of have your server kludge together some templates or serve some sort of no JavaScript, something that contains the content that Google can search. I mean, there's a bunch of different solutions out there, but there's no clear path, and it's something that you don't just get for free. You have to think about it. You have to spend developer cycles. It could get expensive. I mean, there's that. We didn't talk about that. There's older browser support that we talked about. I mean, for me, that's really it, because once you start removing those hurdles, then for me, it's actually easier to work with always on, you know, always persistent. It's easier for me to reason about when I've got, you know, strong models on the client, and there's not this huge disconnect between any time I want to change the state of my application, I've got to reinvent the universe, because universes, it's hard to share data between universes. The only way you can do it is with the preconditions of the Big Bang. It's hard kind of for me to ask that question, but I would say if you're doing stuff that requires interactive visualizations, like a map, like I click on something and I want to see a map update and have it be instantaneous, like with a transition, and not, you know, with a page reload. If I'm, you know, visualizing some network of nodes or something like that, that I want to see rearrange themselves, or I want to react to some new information, if I want the visual display of my application to be highly reactive and in a one that retains fidelity to the identity of the objects that you're representing. In other words, the next state, it's easy to track a move from A to B, then you need to start getting into MVC.
Yeah, things that are interactive are generally highly stateful.
Right.
And you'd be surprised how fast you get into that.
Yeah.
I built a one I built a one field form that you submit an email to invite somebody to something, and its job is to respond and say, hey, congratulations that it invited or it didn't work, or and it does inline validation, and it one field. And I wound up making a mess out of it with jQuery, and I wound up replacing it with an Ember component, and just one little field with a button and some error states and some validations wound up being, wow, this was like, I'm really glad to have had Ember, even though it was a tiny drop-in of Ember, like a little sprinkle of it, it wound up being worth having learned that tool and having learned how to deal with these stateful interactions backed by models. So I've been surprised, like you, at how often I actually wind up being glad to have that tool in my toolkit at times where other times you would think, like, that's just a plain form. You would just submit the form and let Rails submit back that this thing failed, except they said they don't want a full page refresh. So could you please do it with Ajax? And all of a sudden, this thing became much more complex. So things that might look simple on the surface might carry a lot of hidden complexity underneath it. And stateful tools wind up being pretty useful for that. So my recommendation, too, along those lines would be sometimes you are up against a deadline. Sometimes you are, sort of up a creek. And in those cases, I would say, like, there's no shame in forfeiting a battle, but I would hope somebody wouldn't forfeit the war and go find somebody that can show them how it could have been done this other way. But hopefully, in my experience, the times where I've built entire interfaces where I said, wow, I could have just done that in Rails. I could have just done that with flat, stateless pages. That might not have been a good fit in the first place, but I also might have been limited by my own imagination in those situations. So I think that's a good way to wrap that up. And certainly in the future, we'll have more devil's advocates or people who genuinely disagree with us. And those will be fun conversations to have. But that, I think that's a good way to wrap that up for today.
All right.
So one quick note on a personal level, it seemed like it would be improper or ungrateful to not note that this week, the Ruby community has lost someone, and we, both Charles and I think personally have lost somebody that has meant a lot to us. We spent most of the day yesterday talking and processing it, and so I don't want to rehash all the things we talked about, but it would be sort of ungrateful to not publicly acknowledge the influence that Jim Wyrick has had for my part, me personally. Just briefly, like, I had occasion to meet him once or twice, pick him up from an airport, and I will echo a sentiment that I've heard elsewhere that rang extremely true to me, and that is he had the ability to make every person with him feel fascinating. He was truly fascinated with the people that he met, with the technologies that he used, and he helped others become fascinated with the things that he was fascinated by. And it was impossible not to feel loved by him and to feel like that was reciprocal.
I was astounded. What was so striking to me was discovering when I found out that he was gone, how many other people had such a similar experience. Like I, you know, in their interaction with him, what a bright source of light, and what a integral, like what a integral part of the community he was, and how the interactions they had with people were so similar in such a wonderful way. The way that he made me feel was the way that he made everybody else feel.
And it doesn't make it any less special.
Yeah,
and
no, it makes so it absolutely more special.
And something you said yesterday that I want to echo that to kind of tie it together is that you had said that you felt a new burden resting, almost viscerally, like felt a burden resting on you and on me and on the community to try to take up that bright spot and become that light that Jim was for this entire community, for people in technology. And I think that's a good reminder. It's something that is
right. Because whether you're sobering up to the challenge or not, like that, it is up to us to hold the light at this point.
The need is there now. So I hope that everybody within any kind of earshot has a similar feeling of being willing to pick up the mantle and willing to be a source of love and of light and to be fascinated by the people around you. I think that would be the number one lesson I took. Anyway, from everybody here at the Front Side, thanks for listening. We love you guys. and have a great week.
Yeah. Have a great week.